reach the Outrider Podcast. Hello and welcome to the laboratory. This is a new series on the Outrider Podcast. Of course, I am Jason Quinn Malott, and the other person that's going to be here with the show with us is Stephen McClurg. He's a poet, an English teacher, a scriptwriter for comic books, graphic novels, things like that. Overall, a very smart and productive guy who I'm quite jealous of in a lot of ways. So I decided I would give him one more distraction by forcing him to talk to me once a month about experimentation, improvisation, exercises, and give him an assignment. Well, give each of us an assignment that we'll then go out and do over the next month and then come back and share those with each other and with you here on the show. I think it'll be fun. It'll be interesting. And the rules for each exercise that we give each other will be in the show notes so that you can follow along. And if you want, you can then send your results, your whatever material you generate to me here at the show. And we'll post that along and share that on the episode along with what Stephen and I do. So, of course, you can hit the website, jquinnmalott.com, and send me an email at quinn09@jquinnmalott.com with your generated material from the exercise, and we'll share that in the next episode. So get on it. And what else? Any other news? This series, The Laboratory, will be coming out on the first Monday of each month. We have new episodes, the rebooted Shop Talk with Gavin Pate, which will come out on the second Monday of every month. And then on the third Monday of every month, we will have the regular Outrider Podcast interview. Don't know who it's going to be for April yet. Part of the thing with doing this all by myself, from the scheduling and the production and recording and talking and everything like that, is, I have to do it by myself, which, with trying to write and be a human being, which I'm not succeeding at lately, and that's another story entirely. We'll not get into that. I'm failing at humanity, but that's another, that's neither here nor there. Let's get on with my conversation with Stephen, get into the exercises, and join us, all two of my listeners. So, yay! Yeah, I was gonna see how the audio or how the video was working.
Okay, well,
before we get in there, because I did an impromptu one last night with my friend Jen, from Colorado, because she had stumbled across this Esquire article that was about the dust up between Ishiguro and Ursula K. Le Guin.
I haven't heard any. I saw that and it sounds interesting, but I haven't read anything about it.
Yeah. And it sounded like the exact same debate that Jen and I used to have back in Colorado, the genre versus literary. And, I was reading this, thing about the argument between Ishiguro and Le Guin. I thought, didn't Jen and I figure this out 15 years ago?
So was Ishiguro saying he was elevated genre?
No, the thing that ticked off Le Guin was that he was worried that readers wouldn't follow him on this story because they would dismiss it as fantasy. And Le Guin, who's been this tireless kind of champion of fantasy,
The Sorcerer's Stone.
Yeah. She's been this tireless champion of fantasy as a legitimate literary genre. As legitimate literature, and she took umbrage to it. And then when she critiqued Ishiguro's book, she ended up saying that it wasn't really fantasy. Yeah. It was kind of like, okay, so you're upset that he's worried that people, but She didn't do herself any favors with that one.
Oh wow, really? Yeah. I didn't see anything about it, so I wasn't sure what it was about.
But we decided kind of last minute to try and record something of us talking about, that dust up and rehashing our constant ongoing conversation about it.
Yeah, with horror being a horror fan, I mentioned, and I don't know if you had even read those, some of the lists and stuff that I was making for my friend in Finland.
I'd seen them.
One of them, dealing with just there was a whole movement for, or just a lot of younger directors in interviews for a while were talking about how they didn't make horror films, they made elevated genre. And I just thought that was just so condescending and just.
Yeah. I don't know. We've always had this conclusion that, good writing is good writing no matter what.
Yeah, that's I agree.
And what the problem, even with literary fiction, because we read a whole bunch of articles before we sat down and talked to each other, and someone had tried to make the case, that literary fiction isn't really a genre because, writers are all over the place. But it is. It has its own strict set of tropes and requirements and what it cannot be and what it cannot contain.
What was the Buildings Roman or whatever that you were talking about?
The first person semi-autobiographical Buildings Roman, which was supposed to be the required first novel for anyone out of Iowa or whatever.
New York, or at least it seems like the East Coast couple drama seems to be, the affairs or whatever. I mean, you can say Woody Allen and just, Updike and, Roth. And I mean, it's a...
And Franzen, even with that last one.
Exactly. Whatever.
But there was an interesting term I stumbled across and all of that called, this one guy referred to the persistence of cliche as the thing that's really the holdback and what's the biggest, most legitimate knock against, genre like science fiction and fantasy. And he tried to make the case that the idea of the persistent cliche doesn't show up so much in literary fiction. I thought, no, it does. The persistent cliche shows up in literary fiction. It's just we don't really notice it that easily because the persistent cliche that shows up in literary fiction
is subtle, the same in vampires.
Right. It's the same kind of – what did I say to Jen last night? We walk past persistent cliche on our way to work every morning. When we come across it in fiction, we treat it the same way. We just walk right by it and don't see it. That doesn't mean it's not there.
Definitely.
It's just not as glaringly obvious, as a brave, good-hearted hobbit is in fantasy fiction. Right?
Exactly. Bearded wizard or whatever. But right. Same thing with poetry in the sense of the quiet poems about daily life or whatever that, really heavy, serious poetry from. Kind of, I guess the stuff that maybe in some way was kind of working against the beats, from the 70s, at least through the 90s, and you still have it today, but that, quiet domesticity of...
Right.
Or the poet who knows all the names of those flowers and trees.
Nature poet, right?
And, I don't even know if they are in nature, that's one of those things that's always struck me is that
the arborist poet,
I can read Rothke and I can read Frost and other poets who deal with nature, even Dickinson, but there's something about, 90s and particularly a crop in the 90s, but maybe it extends to now, that we're so specific about those plant names and stuff. Sometimes I'm like, I just don't know what that looks like. It's so specific,
Right. Well, actually, that persistent cliche thing plays into exactly what we've been talking about, wanting to talk about with this experiment.
Have we started?
Yeah,
no?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you sneak it in there.
I
I
sneak
know.
it in there. Well,
And yeah, you don't let me like pick a topic that we can think about or anything. So, you know, it's your style. So
But
I
this
know,
is the
but I'm
but
not
our topic is about
dark.
experimentation and
Yeah, I,
improvisation,
yeah,
Stephen.
yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. But then you're so vague about that. Like, well, maybe it doesn't mean anything in terms of, yeah, okay.
Right. Yeah. Well,
I'm figuring it out.
on one hand, I'm trying to avoid being pushed in the corner, but at the same time, you know.
No, it's just you like I'm such the other, like I like to do a bunch of research and I like to have all these things like cataloged and ready, you know? 'Cause like literally like the other podcasts that I've done have been things like, you know, Lewis Carroll and logic and like
Right.
you know, the problems of infinity and like stuff like that, like very like specific. So I'm just always like ready for a specific topic and like you manage to avoid that no matter how many emails or whatever I mentioned. Like you always subverted it.
Well, that doesn't mean we can't pull into it. Because
I know, I
we
just
can't
like the
do
way that
that.
you wouldn't
Oh yeah,
you
and all the emails, right? I wouldn't commit to
wouldn't
anything.
commit to anything. So it's like, oh, I know he's doing it on purpose.
Well, yeah, I want to. I felt like if we overplanned the first one, then we would be stuck in a mode.
What is this one?
And well, I
What are
think this one right
these?
here is what we're trying to do is we're trying to figure out, because one of the things in our email exchange that kind of made me want to be vague was that it sounded like well, particularly when you shot back with the email about not knowing much about experimental fiction, and I got this impression that you were driving towards making this about let's create some experimental fiction, and I was like, no, this is more about experimentation because
Oh,
it
okay.
goes back into that persistent cliche thing. One of the story that I wanted to start with and tell with is I once took a workshop with the poet Laura Mullen, who teaches down at, I think it's LSU, or something like that. Where's her bio here? Anyway, I don't,
I can't
she's down
imagine.
in
LSU
Louisiana.
is that in where is that? That's not New Orleans, is it? That's
Yeah,
in
she's in New Orleans or Baton Rouge or somewhere
Baton
around in
Rouge.
the.
I think LSU is in Baton Rouge, yeah. I can't
And.
imagine going to college down there
Yeah.
as an undergraduate. Like,
I
seems
took.
the worst place ever.
Why is it the worst place ever?
Just debauchery. I
Oh.
mean, this, you know, just wow. I mean, there's so much.
I could do with some debauchery.
There's just so much good music, and just yeah, all the other stuff that goes with good music.
Right.
Good food. It's just yeah. I've never not had fun. Well, one time I didn't have fun in New Orleans, but every other time I've had fun. I'll just
Yeah.
put that.
I need to have more fun. I think that's why we're doing this. But that workshop that I took with her, she walked in there. It was a week-long workshop, and what we had to do was follow these rules. They were these structured rules that she had to create a text. And the first thing we had to do was get a source material. I think I used a Faulkner story, which I can't something Emily Flowers
Rose
for,
for Emily?
yeah, Rose for Emily. And you took a section of that story, and then you blocked out pieces of it to make,
Oh, okay.
you eliminated text to that, and then you, I don't remember what the next step was. I think the next step was to write some original text, and then you bring in a song, or you bring in some other element. I mean, she had like three or four steps on it, and
like when you did the blackout of the section, like was that looking for phrases or words?
And no,
phrases then transferred over to your original document, or was it just seen as like inspiration?
We had to black out text, and then what was left, you know, we constructed into a new text.
Using the actual words.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Right. And there was no guidelines for what you blacked out. You just blacked out whatever you want, just blind, whatever. And then you took what was left, you typed it into a new section, you know, and then you brought in some other text and blended it in with that one. Then you brought in something else that you wrote and you blended it in with that one. Then you brought in something from, it was like a 4-step process. And the whole point of it and the confrontation that she and I had in the first day was that I've always had a bit of a problem kind of releasing control of my projects and just letting them go where they wanted to. Not that I outline or plan, but I'll tend to stop and put on the brakes on something and think about it, where I want it to go, where do I want it to go. And what her process was doing was going without any plan or forethought, or you're just kind of gut reacting and mashing these texts together. And at first, you know, I wanted to resist, and then eventually gave into it and created a text that I really enjoyed.
Oh, cool.
And liked. And it also opened up some of those avenues of creativity, some possibility in the way that I structured and thought about story, that kind of opened up and allowed some of the interesting stuff that I did with that first novel. Because I was take her workshop about the time that I started working on The Evolution of Shadows. And although that experiment didn't have anything, nothing from that experiment came and made it into the book.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say, like, yeah, I don't get a feel of that at all from the novel.
But
yeah.
What it did was it allowed it,
sensitivity to language.
Opened up this little bit of sensitivity. It loosened up my kind of anxiety and need for control over the manuscript that I was writing. And so what I thought was, we start off somewhere like in that, in this, because to me, what's always impressed me about what you do and the work and all the stuff that I see you churning out, some of the stuff we can't talk about, can we? We can talk about some of it.
Yeah, some we can, yeah, yeah. Now, like some of it was, I got the.
I mean, the
mail today,
yeah,
so to speak. And, yeah, I got the, I don't know the it was. The sensors were lifted
right.
On some of it.
But we can talk about the first big one, the one that's you've already been to a convention for, right? Ghoulanoids, we can talk about that one.
Yeah, we're no, that's in the summer.
Okay.
I can hint towards what's gonna happen. I mean, one thing with that is there were a lot of pre-orders, and that thing was supposed to come out in October, the first book of it. And all I can say is I've got kids, Derek has kids, and sometimes there are things that are more important than
a book.
Art.
Yeah.
And we've just had some issues like that. I mean, it sucks that we've had a great pre-order for that book, and you know, I'll have to apologize to Ian at Sacred Prism for the late of delivering that. I've seen the pencils. The pencils are really awesome. I can't wait to see the whole thing. And you know, that's something that maybe like we can talk about at some point, just the process of that. But yeah, Derek and I were both trying to do something that either we felt we hadn't seen that much in comics, or something that we wanted to see, something like that.
Right.
And I hate that it's so late, but like I said, you know, sometimes there are things that you just have to deal with, and that's been the case. And I mean, if it would have been anything else, you know, there wouldn't be any excuse, but you know, sometimes you have to, there are certain things, you know, when you have kids that you have to deal with. And that's the kind of stuff, I mean, that's part of our delay on it. But the book's going to be really, really cool. And the thing that I can talk about with that is we've been picked up. And, you know, if everything works as it should, based on that, we've been picked up to do an expanded full graphic novel of that, or at least a comic or graphic novel of that story. Because for the initial one, there's like 300 to 400% of it was axed for the first section, and. Yeah, so that's going to be cool, and so I'm actually working on the next. I guess it'll be that will be one of the comics that will be a comic. So there'll be, we've at least gotten a couple of things picked up to do more of Illuminoids.
Right.
So once that first book hits, it'll be a collector's item because it's, you know, it's a small pressing. You can get the toys and all that stuff. it's been fun, but yeah, it, you know, sometimes other things are more important.
Right. But not only that comic book and other stuff that you're working on and can't talk about, you know, you're turning out poetry, you've done film, you've done music, your productivity and creativity astounds me, where mine feels very minimal and isolated. And so what when we had first talked about doing a recurring podcast, I thought, well, I would feel a bit like my friend Laura, who kind of wanted to back away from the Shop Talk episodes because she wasn't producing.
Right.
You know, and if I thought, well, what could
which we do? Which were good episodes. I mean, yeah. You know.
What could we do that wouldn't leave me sitting there going like, wow, I wrote 2 pages this last week and Steven did.
Yeah, but you're doing novels. I mean, novels are still, like, I don't care. Like, still novels have that, you know. I'd love to have a novel out there. I'd love it.
But I figured by talking about experimentation and improvisation and then also giving ourselves exercises and challenges to do each month between our conversations, it could drive my creativity, and maybe we could generate something for you that would lead somewhere.
Yeah, I generally like using weird, odd rules that I make up just to, you know, it's that thing of, you know, if you don't have any restrictions, you can kind of feel stuck because,
right.
Well, anything's an option. But like, if you just, you know, make stupid rules for certain things or block it off in a certain way, I've never done anything that extensively of blending, like what you were talking about. I have done cut ups and I've done mashes of things, and right. I've produced like vocal texts by like taking first I wrote all this music, and then for part of that music, what I did was I took the Book of the Dead, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and just ran it through like a bunch of the online cut up filters. And you know, and then I would just keep recycling it so that it would just, I did it at least 4 or 5 times. Until I got these really weird pieces, you know, fragments.
Uh-huh.
And then I took all those fragments and then I made a text from these, like, very, very cut up forms of one version of a translated Egyptian Book of the Dead. But I've never, I guess one of my rules that I've never blended text that way, except... as just inspiration in my own stuff. You know what I mean? Like I've never like done like a cut up of this and then a cut up of that and then put those together. Like for me, that feels not wrong, but like it just feels strange. That's it, you know,
too
that's
much all at once.
Yeah, yeah, just right, that feels strange, you know, and that she would have you do that when you said, like, at least, like, four, like, maybe four texts or three right, or four texts, like, it would just...
Well, it wasn't, we didn't do the block out and the cut up on all of the text. It was you did the block out on one, and then you brought in another text, and then another text on top of that to twist it again. You could mash them up, people had the option to do whatever they wanted with them.
Oh, okay. But still, okay. Well, I mean, what does that mean? Did you have to use pieces of the text, or could you just be inspired from it?
Yes, both.
Oh, okay. That's different. Like, yeah, the that's one thing with the Gulenoid stuff is we started with one idea and it got totally ran through this weird blender of things, you know? So everything from Beckett, I was researching Puritan sermons. I was listening to glossolalia, people speaking in tongues, and listening to recordings of possessions and like ghost recordings and
right,
things like that. That all got. I mean, eventually that's hopefully what will make it interesting. And what's cool is, as far as working with Derek, is that it's not only that in terms of the writing and the text, is like with art now, like we're both sharing, you know, visual texts and literary texts. Mm-hmm. You know, he's bringing up literary texts that have influenced him. And like just last night, we had this long conversation about one part was Ron Cobb. He's a production designer, and he did all of these. He did all these great illustrations for Alien, like to design the spaceship in the inside.
Oh, right, right.
But he also did semiotic standards, like basically all of the non-word things, like zero gravity, coffee, like all of these emblems that are in the ships. That have no words, that are meant to be like, well, if you're multilingual, you can look at that and you go, oh, that's a coffee cup, I can get coffee here.
Right.
Or like, there's zero gravity, you're going to like ram your head into the ceiling or whatever. He did all these signs. He calls them semiotic standards that were, he illustrated for Alien, that are like around the ship. And so I found like blocks of these and all of that. And we were talking about that. And then... movie posters from Ghana, movie posters from Poland, all this Czech and Hungarian animation stuff. I mean, that was just last night. And so,
was that the link that you sent me earlier?
One of them, yeah.
Haven't had a chance to look at that. That's what I was going to do. Sitting around with my thumb at my butt this afternoon.
Well, no, I mean, I haven't watched all of it yet because it was so overwhelming. It's like someone took... It's like... Okay, Avan Earl, do you know who that is?
No.
He's the guy who basically, he was a painter, but he did all of the design stuff for Sleeping Beauty, the Disney film.
Okay.
Just Google image Avan Earl. You're going to see some of the most masterful paintings that you've ever seen. And there's a documentary on YouTube about him, autobiography documentary that he did. Avan Earl. It's like Avan Earl and Jodorowsky, who did Holy Mountain and that stuff, and like Joseph Campbell all worked on this animated film. And that's that one I sent you, the Son of the White Mare. It's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life. Just
Joseph Campbell, our favorite Joseph Campbell?
Yes, yes. It's like, it's kind of Beowulf, but blended with these Hungarian folk tales. It's a hero, it has a element of a kind of hero tale, but then it has particular things to these Hungarian folk tales.
How does, is it?
E-Y-V-I-N-D, I believe. And then E-A-R-L-E. his painting and stuff is just, it's incredible.
Oh, Evan Earl, there we go. The nice thing about having, you know, two computers set up on your desk.
I'm always afraid I'm going to cut off one.
Okay, because I'll add links to our show notes for some of the stuff we talk about.
Well, Son of the White Mare is absolutely, to me, it was like, I'm a big fan of stop motion animation and like Ray Harryhausen stuff going way back, even to King Kong, but Jan Svankmajer are three, the Brothers Quay twins, but they're just my favorite artists ever. And this was like that surprise, that kind of there was a certain thing that happened, like when I read Emily Dickinson and Samuel Beckett for the first time, that surprise, that difficulty, not understanding everything completely, but being enraptured by it. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right, right.
Does that make sense?
Oh yeah.
Their films have always given me that. And watching The Son of the White Mare, it was the same thing. It was like watching El Topo or Holy Mountain or something. Huh. It just, you know, as Emily Dickinson, you know, top of your head comes off. And just. It was that feeling.
Right.
So we were just talking about all that stuff last night. And then also, like, you know, He-Man and a lot of 80s toys cartoons.
Right.
And 80s toys commercials and stuff were, you know, we grew up on that stuff. And one of the things with Derek is just we don't see any kind of high-low difference. It's all there, you know, for inspiration and valid, you know, invaluable in some sense.
So how much where do you think they got these the people that inspired you, where did they get their inspiration for this interesting stuff that pulls back the top of your head? Have you traced the lineage back on that?
I mean, Emily Dickinson, I don't know. You know, I mean, does anyone know? I mean, you know, she's... Right. What a rich internal life. As far as we know, she must have had. I mean, she doesn't write like anyone that... I mean, I can't think of anyone she would have been reading... You know, the same almost goes for Walt Whitman, you know, like who were they reading that they ended up doing they did, you know?
It was such a giant leap away from everything that was around.
Yeah, to me, those two are always just like fundamentally just I studied a lot of 19th century lit in school and just those two just always. I mean, it's just, you know, their work's just so good. Every time I go back to it, it's just it always pays off, you know. It's just right. It's so for Emily Dickinson, I don't know, and even for Walt Whitman to a certain extent, I don't know what made him do that. The film guys to a certain extent, let's see, I mean, the Brothers Quay are very much influenced by and their stuff is amazing. I mean, they're some of my favorite artists ever who have lived. Street of Crocodiles, one of my favorite films by them, is based on a Bruno Schultz text. I think he was Polish. I'm not sure, but he was killed by the Nazis.
That's always.
He had some you know, some really interesting texts. They're influenced by Robert Walser, who spent time in asylums and whatnot. They're influenced by a lot of 20th, like late 20th and contemporary classical and avant-garde music. Mm-hmm. They're also influenced by a lot of Latin American literature, Kafka. That's where they're you know, surrealism in Jan Svenkmajer was a big, one of their films is The Cabinet of Jan Svenkmajer. So playing off of the cabinet of Dr. Caligari, they have a cabinet of Jan Svenkmajer. Okay. Svenkmajer's influences, as far as I know, I mean, I don't know too much about, I think I've got the only, like, text, like, that's book that's about him that's out. But as a Czech surrealist, his body of work was always influenced by various types of surrealism. And he's done a version of Jabberwocky. He's done a version of Alice in Wonderland. So Lewis Carroll was obviously an influence.
Right.
He's done a couple of versions of Poe. I love Poe. I've read everything he's written at least twice. I'm trying to think of other, I don't think there are any, I can't think of any other literary landmarks for Svenkmajer, but, There's a really beautiful history of Eastern European animation that I'm sure helps. But then also with Jan Svenkmajer, going back to Prague and Rudolf II, there was a Rudolf II during the Renaissance was big into alchemy and mysticism, and that's where you get like the Arcimboldo portraits. The Arcimboldo portraits are the I know there's a name for this style, but it's like the, like a guy, a portrait of a guy, but it's all built out of vegetables, or it's all built out of, hay and sticks. If you look at Arcimboldo, it's like a, and Svenkmajer uses that exact technique, but then animates it sometimes. But that goes back to Rudolf II and his kind of esoteric alchemical interests as a king during the Renaissance in Prague. So there's, you know, Beckett, obviously Joyce. Beckett was Joyce's secretary for a while. Beckett, you know, had Proust, but I mean, I don't know if you necessarily see that in there. I'm trying to think of, like, you know, I don't know. I'm trying to think of other influences that Beckett may have had. I'm not really... And I've read a biography and everything. I've read all of his work, so but I'm kind of drawing a blank.
That's right.
I know he read a, you know, one of his first poems was kind of a biography of French philosopher Descartes.
Mm-hmm.
So I know, like, there were certain philosophical folks in James Joyce that were influenced, that were influential to Beckett.
Right. Yeah, I'm curious because this, I think, is kind of where we might draw some of the requirements and challenges we can set for ourselves is, you know, thinking about who influenced the writers or groups that we like, and then sending ourselves out into the world to find similar elements around us and draw them in and use them to create something, just to get our, particularly me, and I don't know what we'll
we have to figure out
what's going to work for you. I mean, if we're going to challenge each other, we've got to find some way to put this experimentation improvisation challenge on a nice level plane, so that it's doing something for both of us.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you could probably give me assignments day in and day out on shit to go and experiment.
It's part of my job.
What?
It's part of my job.
Yeah. You know,
my other job.
I'm just curious, you know, because we've often commiserated over the fact that we feel like we're in kind of literary wastelands where we live.
Yeah, to a certain extent, definitely. Yeah.
But you have you astound me every single time with the amount of stuff that you get read, even though you teach and have two kids and are seem to be writing constantly.
Yeah, it's total nerd.
And, you know, I'm over here, fighting with my television. You know, I get home from work and it's like, I should run, I should read, I should write something. Watch the next episode of Spartacus.
Fuck. Oh, yeah. You should run and then watch something else. I'm still working through the AF, like my wife jokes. I know no one can see this, but like this here, yeah, this binder, but these are all various lists that I'm working through.
You're crazy.
It's ridiculous. I can't help it, and that's why I don't ever like load up like, oh, this is what I'm reading and watch, like everything that I'm reading, watching, and like kind of attempting to process, because it's so ridiculous and stupid. But like this right here, like these are all lists of,
you're way more organized than I could ever
the
be.
The first part is a book, and then the second part is film. And it's, yeah, my wife, as she just said, this is the binder of neglect. This is where I'm supposedly neglecting my family and other duties, but I don't think so. You can watch a lot of the AFI films with your kids. You know, they may not like them, but
right,
you can watch them with your kids. I don't watch, David Cronenberg with the kids, but
it's probably a good idea.
Yeah, but was it Look Who's Coming to Dinner? Hey, kids can watch that. They're not going to be interested in it at all. That's okay. But
they'll thank you for it when they're at least two lists.
Right. At least two of the lists have that one on there. Sidney Poitier is an attractive man.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that. No, it's a disturbing. I don't know. Not a problem. I mean, it's fine. It's my entertainment. That's how, right, I entertain myself.
I don't even know how I figure out how to entertain myself anymore. I think that's...
Well, you look up, you go, well, the library never has the current award winners because they're always checked out. So what you do is you go 5 years back to 2010 and you look at the award winners in 2010... Mm-hmm. And you can go down the list of the Edgar, the Philip K. Dick Award, the Bram Stoker, the Pulitzer, the Nobel. You can go who won these various ones. And that's part of what I'm doing right now is looking at, I just said, well, I'll go 5 years back and I can go 5 years back and, hey, all those books are actually in the library. Because I remember in 2010, I actually tried to find some of those books, and they were all checked out, and it was like a long wait, that kind of thing. So,
all this discipline, why haven't you written a novel yet?
Novels are hard. Novels are hard. Well, because I'm probably spending too much time reading and watching stuff rather than writing. I do, I get between an hour and 2 hours about it every day, mm-hmm, that I focus on writing right now. When the kids get older, it'll probably increase. But that's about it. And, to sustain the, essays are different because you can kind of come back to them.
Right.
And poems generally, I've never really written very long poems, so it's never been a problem with that. The longer narratives of the comic, it's just a different, it's a different thing because I am writing in a certain element the whole thing, but I'm not, right. it's a script. So it's, right. It's a blueprint.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing about screenwriting. One of the things that I've I always keep telling myself I should try to do is write, particularly crank out a screenplay of the novel. But it would be fairly easy to do, but it's...
Well...
That's the one thing... Well, I mean, I know the story. I kind of...
It'd be cool... No, that'd be a cool exercise. I mean,
It's just the... I don't know, there's...
I've got several screenplays first to get a hang of that.
And, yeah.
One of them I remember was Sideways. I typed out... it was one of the Coen Brothers scripts. I typed out a couple of scripts just to, get that. And then once I did that, though, the structure and everything kind of fell into place, the feel. But one of the things I like about Guillermo del Toro is he just says, he just writes the script. He doesn't worry about the whole three-act structure. He doesn't worry about any of that stuff. But,
right.
Maybe part of that is because he's going to be directing it himself, and
yeah,
most of that happens editing. Like what he talks about is most of that happens in editing anyway.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Where it gets trimmed down to that kind of structure.
Yeah. Now you can edit a movie so that it just doesn't seem to match the script at all. One of the important texts that I stumbled across when I was in school was. The Conversations, which was between Michael Ondaatje and...
Was it Berger?
No, it was...
So this was an actual film?
No, this was a book called The Conversations. Michael Ondaatje interviewing the film editor. He won an Academy Award for The English Patient. He did a... he was involved with Apocalypse Now. He re-edited Touch of Evil according to the notes left by this is another one of those days for me where I can't remember
Walter Murch?
Name. Walter Murch, yes!
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. And just the way Murch talked about film, it applied a lot to ideas I've had about how to structure fiction at this particular time. You know, so
yeah, I find like learning about, but that part of that is for me, it was like Lynn Sloan that you talked to, you know, because I didn't get an MFA that maybe something I really like craft books and I like looking at them and kind of, even if I don't do the exercises or anything, just reading them is kind of inspiring sometimes. But also sometimes thinking about like what's going on in them, just because I didn't take those MFA classes. I didn't take classes in screenwriting. You know, I just watch a lot of movies. I didn't take those classes. So it's you know, I haven't had those conversations. So it's interesting to have to. At least see someone or hear someone talk about that stuff, you know?
I don't know how, well, I'm working on an essay right now, kind of cataloging my, I guess you'd call it the journey from, you know, growing up out in the sticks of Western Kansas to, you know, realizing that I could actually be a writer. You know, because there was no direction or support or anything like that until I got to college, and going to graduate school for me, because of my lack of discipline and my rather erratic and eclectic reading habits, I don't have the I wouldn't be able to stick to some of the reading plans that you've described where you and Eric seem to be going through, you know, the entire body of work by a writer. You know, I don't know that I could do that.
Yeah.
And that actually is a good substitute for an MFA and probably a whole lot cheaper.
It's a lot of fun, too, especially when you have someone else doing it with you because I'd gone through most of Borges, Kafka. I mean, tons of writers, but Joyce, everything. But it's nice, like with Eric right now, we're working on Faulkner. Like as we read through a whole author's work, it's just, you know, it's so interesting to see the author over that chronology, but then also to realize, like, especially those who have these reputations like Faulkner or Hemingway or Vonnegut, right, how much of their work doesn't adhere to that easy, simple classification, that the shorthand,
right,
and that's what has been one of the biggest things that I've noticed with that, and particularly like after reading Hemingway and then going to Faulkner, like, why does anyone compare these? Why is that? Like, why is that the thing that I, you know, I mean, I mentioned this on a blog, but I mean, who reads blogs anymore? But, like,
I think you and I reading each other's blog is about, yeah, or about the last people left.
Probably, but, you know, or those in the weird people who like my blog, who are like writing, you know, who all seem to be writing about writing in Indonesia or something. I don't know. you know, all through college and grad school, people were talking about this, you know, this kind of verses or this thing about, like, you know, are you a Hemingway fan or a Faulkner fan? Mm-hmm. And I was always like, well, I like both. I mean, you know, what I've read by both of them seems pretty cool so far. But actually sitting down and reading through their work chronologically, it's like, why is, you know, I mean, yeah, they lived at the same time, but like, that's ridiculous to be the mean, like, because right, they lived at the same time that you would, and there was a rivalry there. I mean, there is a noted, you know, they did write stuff back and forth to each other and
yeah,
bitched at each other and in kind of a funny way, really, most of the time. But it's like, they do not have similar goals.
Right.
They are not attempting to write the same type of novel, mm-hmm, at all. Like, so why compare them? Who cares? You know, I mean, they're, you know, like, why aren't you bringing up, you know, I don't know, you know, Asimov was writing too. Like, yeah, why not bring, you know, it's just, there's no reason. And that becomes more clear as I spend the time actually like dealing with, you know, someone's work.
Yeah,
that's become especially clear. Like Faulkner and Hemingway couldn't have had more different goals,
mm-hmm,
in their fiction.
So, who on the fiction side, on the novel side, is some of your experimental avant-garde touchstones? For me, there's always Italo Calvino is someone who just completely, you know,
so good,
gets outside of the normal structures. He's doing something different with,
well, I sent you that chart, like I got obsessed.
You're right.
I mean, it's part of the, like, the you know, the just the it, yeah, yeah, once I watched that documentary,
uh-huh,
and he showed this chart, the scheme, and this is just a Joyce thing, you know, right? It's like the whole schema for Ulysses that may or may not be what he actually used for the book.
Right.
I have a feeling that he did, but whatever. I mean, some people say that the schema was drawn up later, but I don't see it. Anyway, once Calvino, like in that thing, like in that little documentary of, like, you know, newscast or whatever, showed that chart of, like, well, this is kind of one of the things I was thinking of, you know, I draw these pictures sometimes for these novels. I was like, oh my God, I've got to find out, like, what that is. And so, yeah, I spent like 2 or 3 days translating Italian. And then
and this I was
went
that,
to our lab.
That step chart.
Yeah, yeah. I went to the Latin teacher who has a background in Italian, and I was like, man, can you, like, talk to me about this? And he had read some Calvino. So, mm-hmm, he kind of had an idea, and that happens to be like one of the like his novel I haven't read. I need to read it. I have it, and I'm ready to read it. Read it. But like, I was so obsessed with that chart, like I had to. But it gives me an idea of what he's doing in the novel. You know, here are these genre or generic first chapters.
Right.
I can't wait to read it. But yeah, I was totally obsessed with that schema. I guess guys that I've looked to for that, it's just weird. Like it's always easier for me to talk about it in music and film, like I told you.
Right.
Because to me, like when I think about
who should we look at?
There's always a weird thing with literature for me. Like, you know, Beckett won the Nobel Prize and stuff. Like, is he, you know, is he experimental? You know, I mean, like when you've had that kind of legitimacy, you know, I mean, Borges, I think is amazing. And I think at times really interesting. Philip K. Dick, Robert Walser. I mean, the Quay brothers influenced me to go read Bruno Schultz and Robert Walser.
Right.
And some of the Walser's stuff is microfictions, like stuff that he wrote that were literally like letters that were like micrometers small on the, you know, I mean, again, he was in institutions for a while.
Right.
And then I begin to think like, well, what is, you know, as far as literature goes, like what is experimental? Stanislaw Lem, who wrote Solaris, has got this amazing book called A Perfect Vacuum.
Right.
Where each chapter of the book is a review of a book that doesn't exist, but within each chapter he deals with, and including like the intro is like a, like one of the reviews is the review of A Perfect Vacuum, but it's the perfect vacuum that doesn't exist.
Right.
It's like the book that isn't the book that you're reading. So,
right. Well,
you know, his stuff is so good. And very, very, very funny, which doesn't come across in, like, say, the Solaris film. The same thing with, like, say, the difference between Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep and Blade Runner. You know, right. Philip K. Dick is hilarious and very funny and meant to be kind of funny, kind of poking fun at, you know, these existential problems to a certain degree. And that never – that doesn't carry into the film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've read a lot of Gertrude Stein, and a lot of stuff that is supposed to be experimental to me often sounds a lot like Gertrude Stein, like a lot of language poets and stuff. And so I never think like, oh, wow, that's experimental or that's this or that. It just is like, no, I mean, it sounds like something Gertrude Stein wrote in the 20s.
Did you ever read anything by Robert Coover?
That name doesn't, I'm not sure. I've read a lot of short stuff by a lot of people. And unless I have that title, I may not remember, but like what kind of stuff?
There were fragments of his stuff that I read. Well, he was a postmodernist experimental.
Yeah. Guy. A lot of those guys I haven't read. No, I haven't read,
but I've read fragments of some of his stuff, but the one novel of his that I read that I found really fascinating was called Spanking the Maid.
No, I haven't read that. I'll remember that. Yeah.
And, you know, I was listening to a podcast today. I was listening to actually Dan Savage's podcast, and he had on one of his dominatrix associates, and they were talking about all the different books and movies that you could watch that were better than 50 Shades of Grey.
There were plenty. Yeah.
Plenty. And I was thinking to myself, yeah, one of them that could be put in place of 50 Shades of Grey is something that's better, much more, you know, both erotic and, you know, significant from a literary standpoint is Coover's Spanking the Maid, which is, it's structured on repetism. Did I say that right? Repetition. Repetition.
Yeah. Okay. Like
repetition.
Like whipping or spanking, right? Yeah.
But So,
like visiting a dominatrix, like the repetition of visits, or even like right. the spanking well, aspect or the
what this is
whipping
is
that the, or whatever.
The story is the same scene repeated again and again, but with subtle changes. Every morning, the maid comes into the guy's room. She does something wrong. He spanks her, and then it repeats something. And then there's a little subtle shift in the scene. And by the end of the book, the maid comes into the room and she's spanking the guy. Total, you know, sexual reversal yeah. of dominance. It's a fascinating little book, just with these little.
In a way, that sounds like Beckett, but like Beckett, mm-hmm. there would be no. How do I say it? I mean, there would be no erection. There would be no. you know. That would at least be part of it. There would be the repetition, but there would be, you know, no consummation, no anything.
But yeah, it's so, just that same scene again and again, but with slight tweaks until by the end of the thing, the whole dynamic of the relationship is switched. It's a very.
But is it, you've read If on a Winter's Night,
yes.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, isn't that kind of what Calvino's doing, right? But he's or. I mean, is he doing the same scene in different genres, or is he expanding the story in different genres?
No. Once you get into the book with the overarching story of If on a Winter's Night a Traveler is it's kind of like metafiction. You have gone to pick up the new book by Italo Calvino, If on a Winter's Night a Traveler, and you start reading it, and you read the opening scene, and then suddenly it's gone, and it's a new book. It's a completely different book. So you go to the bookstore, and you ask the bookstore, well, what's wrong with this book? Where's the rest of If on a Winter's Night a Traveler by Calvino? And so it turns – it's kind of – it's a commentary on the reading process and how readers get sucked into and obsessed with a book and interested in it. And also kind of a detective story. You, quote unquote, the character, are trying to figure out what's with the printing errors that you keep getting the first chapter of a book and not the rest of the book as you're going. And it's so, yeah, it's this kind of metafiction approach to our interest in stories. And it's so that's
it
what it's about.
That reminds me of, yeah, tonally, that reminds me of Lem's A Perfect Vacuum. Where you're,
I kind of want to tell you where that goes, but then again, it would be like a spoiler. So fucking read the book.
yeah, I've got it. It's very close. It's right up there.
Oh yeah, it's one. It's definitely
like Bartlemy and Art. Like all those guys are, they're right up on the list. But see, I've read Bernard, Thomas Bernard, and I've read a little bit of Sebald, and I like that stuff a lot.
Right. I do too, and that's now.
I haven't read like a lot of those like major guys who are considered like postmodern metafiction guys.
Right. Yeah. The reason I'm very interested in experimentation and kind of the avant-garde and improvisation and pulling inspiration and structure and technique from all of these other genres is. I have a couple of stories that I'm working on that I feel like I'm stuck on. And the reason I'm stuck, of course, is twofold. My own particular lineage as a writer is very realist and, you know, coming out of Hemingway and Kerouac, which Kerouac was experimental in being very personal and trying to adopt jazz as an inspiration. But of course he had a lot more time on his hands to sit there and write. Cause his whole thing was you practice writing, you practice writing, you practice writing, you practice writing, you sit down, you write the book. And that's how On the Road got written as a giant scroll.
You know, yeah, I haven't read much of his stuff besides On the Road,
right.
And the thing that struck me with it was just the beauty of the beauty of it and the and the ability that he had to capture that voice of like someone sitting next to you and telling you that story.
Right. But when you take a step back from the way that he created that, you still have a very naturalistic, realist story.
Yeah.
It's a conveyance of real life.
Right, not Burroughs.
Well, not definitely not Burroughs in his cut-up phase. When you had Burroughs in the junky, you know, queer and naked and
well, phase, not naked was, lunch. Yeah,
maybe not naked lunch. But
yeah, junky and queer though. Yeah, you're. I see the connections there. I mean, maybe whenever he starts getting into the,
but I think what might have been experimental with naked lunch was more the. Might be more attributed to drug hallucination than anything else.
All kinds of, well, I mean, he was studying, he was looking at like the argones, and
did you watch
all different kinds of conscious, you know, consciousness?
Did you see training. The recent movie of On the Road that they made?
I have not, but I know it has. There was the big stink, right?
Yeah, but they've got a they've got a hilarious.
Bella had an affair with the director, right?
I don't know.
Bella from Kristen Stewart from the Twilight movies, I think, had an affair with the director.
I didn't know anything about that. No, I didn't know about that.
And that caused a big stink. But is it good? I haven't seen it. I don't.
No, it's decent. You know, that's the thing with trying. I guess particularly trying to put Kerouac on film is that it's
not really.
How do you take something that is a literary episode. Linguistic performance on the page and translate into that? Effectively onto the screen, and I don't think it's possible. But
I've only read that book once. The thing that I came away from it with was the power of that voice. That was the what I remember most from it was like, wow, he really captured, and that seemed different to me from the literature from the time period. Was like he really seemed to capture a voice of someone speaking to you, you know, about these stories, things that happened. Right.
And that's that and Hemingway and stuff is the tradition that I come from. But my own particular interest, you know, because of Calvino and even some of Salman Rushdie, who's a bit of a surrealist at times.
Can be, yeah.
And other writers that I've stumbled across just by happenstance. And then taking with that the way that I... some ideas that I have about telling stories and the kind of stories that I want to tell at the moment, I don't have the tools. I don't feel like I have the tools for it. So experimentation, you know, playing around with pulling that in there. Interesting. I have these writer salons every month in my apartment, and one of the people that shows up is a graphic artist.
Wow. Yeah, it sounds like those are going well from what you said.
It drives him fucking batty when I do this chart. I have this chart. No one on the podcast will be able to see it, but I'm going to try and show it to you. Oops, headphones are in the way. And I don't know if you'll be able to see it very well.
I can see it sort of, but not clearly.
Right. Anyway, so it's basically Joseph Campbell's hero's journey.
Oh, okay, yeah.
With
I've seen, I know that chart. I know the monomyth chart well.
With it divided into three quadrants, and the three quadrants make up the three novels that I want to write. So the first one, which I just finished trying to sell, is this traditional, linear, straightforward narrative. And then the second one, the one that I'm having problems with is supposed to be this kind of disjointed experimental hodgepodge thing where narrative and tradition and the old myth has been completely broken down and disoriented, disarrayed, dissected, you know. And then the third book will be the reconstruction into a new...
Is that reconstruction like the return in some way?
Right, or? Exactly. So, but, you know, because I'm so stuck with, you know, my heritage is... comes from the Hemingway realist, but also from the very linear adventure fiction that is basically science fiction, which is what I grew up reading. But yet my middle story, the one that I'm trying to write now, involves me completely disordering narrative structure. And I've been trying to find a book that would provide an example of that for me. And I may have found one by a guy named Julio Cortazar. He's an Argentinian writer. And he's got a book called Hopscotch, which, according to the description I've read about it, can be read in any order.
I want to say have we talked about that book?
About Hopscotch? No.
But okay, the Latin teacher that helped me with the Calvino chart, he told me about that book. It was either you or him. Yeah, he told me about that book.
So I need to hunt that one down. I think that might be a thing. But then again, just because somebody has done this once,
Well, you know, Finnegan's Wake, you know, mm-hmm. the sections of that, the four main sections can, you know, Joyce, the idea was that you could read any of those four sections in any order you wanted, because of the recursive idea of Bruno, mm-hmm. is my understanding of it. That you didn't have to necessarily read Finnegan's Wake in those four sections as they are.
Right. So what do you think is the thing that's... What's troubling you with your work right now? What are you struggling with?
My struggles right now really tend to fall into more like practical mm-hmm. kinds of things. Like I leave early to get to work so I can try to write and stuff early. It is getting a little easier to kind of steal time at home, like I am now, but because my wife's in school and also works at night, it's not, you know, a lot of times I'm just on call at night, you know, so right. It's really hard to, you know, even think that I'm going to schedule that time to like do anything, and it's not like right now. My deadlines, because right now my focus is kind of comics and graphic stuff with Derek, my deadlines tend to be way ahead of his.
Right.
So I'm not dealing with the hard and fast end of like publication deadlines like I have in the past. So for me, it's just time. I would love to have more time, but, you know, I teach full time, take care of the kids, you know, made Swedish meatballs and steamed broccoli tonight. So for me, that's like my biggest struggle. in not to fall asleep when I sit in front of like a notebook or something. Yeah. Like mine are more like practical, like those kind of problems. My technique is mostly been, you know, I started out in journalism, so that helped mm-hmm. in terms of trying to weed out the language, you know, like try to censor the language and get it to its like what it needs to be there. Mm-hmm. That always helped. And then I do a ton of drafts, but yeah, that's the thing. Mostly, it's just time, you know. All right.
So, what do you think would that we could do experimentally, you know, as our monthly assignment or something that could help you out? Because me, as long as we're doing something outside of trying to write a linear narrative, I'm good. You want to make me blend texts and do blockouts and cutups and whatever? I'm all for it. Anything that gets me thinking outside of my usual sit down, write the sentence, tell the story type of thing. I'm even having a hard time writing poetry anymore, which used to never be a problem.
Everything starts with images for me. I'm very image based, even if I don't. So for me, like the hard part is it's narrative, and one of the things with the Ghoulanoids was, you know, having all these interests and like, oh, I'm gonna write this, you know, ultimate sci-fi, whatever, sci-fi / horror creature thing, mm-hmm. and then realizing as I wrote, you know, three drafts in and like, oh, I'm focusing on the story, and then realizing, oh wow, it fits perfectly into the hero's journey. Like right. It fit, you know, it's like exactly a third of like that, the Campbell thing. And I was like, you know, then you realize, well, you just go with it. Like, oh, okay. Well, you know, here's a structure that, it wasn't intentional, but like, this is the structure that I accidentally, you know, I had like, you know, with that really bad 80s movie. Well, not bad. I mean, I think actually it's pretty good, but like, you know, 80s horror films like Street Trash and Cronenberg and all this stuff kind of mixing up. And then, you know, literally like Finnegan's Wake and Lucky's Speech and mm-hmm. Waiting for Godot. Those combined with like Pentecostal speaking in tongues. I mean, it's just like the weird, like the you know, I never have a problem with like influences and attempting to like work out something that I'm writing. Mm-hmm. Because part of what I like to do is that, here's Richard Baxter, a Puritan, you know, here's his sermon on how to die well. I'm going to look at that, and then I'm going to look at, you know, here are Pentecostal folks speaking in tongues. Here are radio things of, like, exorcisms and possessions. And lately, like, one of the things I've been looking at for the expanded book of Ghoulanoids is UFO religions, and, like, actually trying to find their documents. Like, there are the thing that I've been looking at more is, like, you know, UFO cults or religions
that
have actually, like, published documents out there that you can go and look at. And, I mean, that's just what, and that's where Derek and I like work well, really, really well together, is that we don't see a division in any of that stuff. All of that kind of feeds mm-hmm. Like what's like, because the alternate to that was the G.I. Joe, okay, you know the back of the G.I. Joe figures, the dossier, the poop sheet.
Yeah.
So the influences for this
I had a shitload of the G.I. Joe stuff when I was
a kid. Yeah. The influences I have. If you go back and read those G.I. Joe dossiers, the poop sheets, some of them are incredibly strange, and in the tone, the shift of tone from like talking about like, oh, he's from Florida and he used to be a swimmer, to like, you know, he may have been, you know, his stepfather burned him with cigarettes, or I mean, they never get that bad, but it's right. Like there's like these bizarre shifts of tones, and so like that, and reading UFO religion documents, those have been the big influences in the thing I'm currently writing for Ghoulanoids.
Do you still have your G.I. Joe action figures and their cards?
I have a lot of them, but they're in my parents' house. Right. I have a lot of books.
Mine too.
So I need to go get all that stuff.
Where are your parents?
They're in Mobile.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot of my Marxist books are all there. I've got to go liberate them.
Yeah. If I weren't living in an apartment, I would get all of my damn toys out of my mother's basement, as well as I still have books in boxes down there.
Yeah, I have tons of books, and my mom has kept a lot of my toys, I think. And they go from mostly it's G.I. Joe, Star Wars,
right.
So
yeah. My problem is that with the G.I. Joe figures, the little black rubber bands that hold them together on the inside,
yeah,
are deteriorating so that they now don't – they come apart. So I need to replace those O-rings.
You know, at some point you got to stop playing with those, Jason.
Figure at some point we have to grow up. But
this is an art object that I just keep on the bookshelf. And you got to let the imagination wander to other things. There's this book called Emmanuel. Have you heard of that?
What, the erotica book? Yeah. Yeah, I've read that a couple of times.
It's much better than the G.I. Joe's ones.
Oh, I know. Anais Nin.
Have you read Tropic of Cancer? Because that's something I read recently.
No. I did have the book at one point, and I think I read part of it and lost interest for one reason or another. I don't remember, and I might have given it away.
It seems like an early novel. You know, it mm-hmm. has that kind of clunkiness of an early novel. And it felt like he was really trying to annoy, like, 1940s, 1950s American housewives, where it just like to me, like it wasn't shocking or anything, and in part that's just, you know, the difference in time. And then at the same time, there were like really very wonderful poetic parts of it, mm-hmm. but it was, you know, it was one of those. The whole time, it's in one of those buildings, Romans. You know, he's talking about, oh, the book I'm going to write. You know? So you can't help but assume, like, you know, this is the book that he's, you know, moving towards. and yeah, it was. I think it loses something in the distance. You know, it's not as shocking. And part of it was, I think he wrote that for the particular shock factor. But there's also some nice poetic stuff about, you know, daily life, but then also like just dirty life. I don't know.
Yeah. So what requirements, what exercise-y things do we want to put on ourselves to create something for next month? What would we like to try our hand at first?
Well, I mean, do you have ideas for that or?
Well, I have my my mass market paperbacks sitting there on the shelf with their covers stripped off. That was the first step in attempting to, do kind of a block out, cut up type of thing, and quickly.
What was that? Oh, okay. With the just like to do a block up. Okay.
Yeah, I mean that was the thing. I mean, I've got like four or five paperbacks over there that I could
That's how
do
little
something
billboards
with.
happen. Those are books that I can't throw away, that die by falling apart, and I can't throw the pieces away, so I end up drawing on them. But I haven't done like a traditional, I haven't ever done like a traditional cut up in that sense, or I just haven't approached things that way. So,
Right.
and how much did Burroughs really, I know like a big, huge influence of that was Brian Gysin. Like, how much did Burroughs? Because I've heard like even things about like cutting a page into fours and rearranging those pages into fours, but it just seems like you would get nonsense. And
Yeah.
Naked Lunch to me isn't nonsense, what
Right.
I've read of it.
No, I think, well, I think it goes back to that exercise process that I went through with Laura Mullen, is that you, once we did the block out stuff, we made further edits to that leftover text so that it became, we could, if we wanted to,
Okay.
so that it became coherent. And then we added in another text that we could manipulate around if we wanted to make coherence out of it, we could.
Okay, so you're not bound by those.
Right, I'm in fact, there was a I should it's I don't know if it's in a it might be in a box in my mother's basement still. I could pull out the end result and I can walk through it and I can show you where the Faulkner text came from, where my additional text came from, where this other element came from. We can kind of reconstruct it.
Oh, okay.
But my own impetus was to put order and structure onto it. There were other people in the class that were perfectly content to construct it as gibberish and random and wildly connected, So, that's if
Yeah,
we're
what attempt?
whatever we decide to do, we can apply our own intention to it. But I'm kind of wondering what should our requirements be? What are we going to do? Do we want to say, take, two mass market paperbacks, cut them up, and or block them out,
Yeah, I'm up
or
for any of those techniques. I mean, I haven't. The most that I've done with any of that is like with the little billboards where it's really like a page or half a page, and that's it. I have to use that page or half a page, and
Okay.
I'm confined to that, and that's.
Okay. Well, let's.
That's it. I haven't attempted anything longer, or I haven't attempted to use that technique get to another place, you know what I mean?
Well, let's start there then. Let's start simple. Here will be the first rule is take 1 to 2 pages from any mass market paperback. And if anyone is still listening at this point, they could, if they want to follow along with our rules, create a text and email it to me. We'll even share those in the next episode. How's that sound?
What was that? I'm sorry, it kind of broke up.
Oh, anybody who is still listening, yeah. if they want to do the exercise along with us, and
send
the results in to me. You know, we can share those in the next episode as well. Kind of get the audience engaged, as well as with whatever we're going to do. So, okay. So rule number one is you take 1 to 2 pages from a mass market paperback, any one that you want. I've got some cheesy romance novels and a Western over there, and I'm going to use one of those.
Awesome.
And you can either do a block out or a cut up. Which is just randomly block out text or cut it up until you've created something that's not what the author intended.
The intent was, yeah.
Yeah. So just, you don't have to follow any internal rules you want for blocking it out or cutting it up. Just do whatever. Rule number two is find a secondary text. It can be dialogue from a movie, song lyrics, some other text that is not a straight narrative. It could be a poem, song lyrics, dialogue from a movie. But
all right.
Some other second.
Yeah, this is. I've never done that. So.
So a second text, and it can be anything that's not prose. And is there a favorite writing exercise that you have?
I mean, as far as like writing, I mean, one of the things that I do a lot is just. 5 or 10 minutes of automatic writing.
Okay.
That is something that I've done for years.
What are your basic guidelines or rules for the automatic writing?
Nothing. It's like literally like the rules are like don't lift your pen up for that 5 minutes or 10 minutes that you're gonna write.
That's what I'm looking for.
And that's more just to get, you know, things kind of bashing together.
5 or 10 minutes of
just free writing.
Automatic free writing. Okay. So this will be our basic rules. We'll come back in a month with a text that's generated from these three rules. We'll take 1 to 2 pages from a mass market paperback. You can do a block out or cut up to create a new text. You'll add a second text, which will be anything that's not prose. It can be poetry, song lyrics, movie dialogue. And then the third one is you will add in or incorporate 5 to 10 minutes of automatic or free writing. And the only rule for that is is you write for 5 to 10 minutes straight. No breaks. Don't take your pen off the page. You can write about anything, or you can write from some level of inspiration having to do with your previous text. But we'll then combine those three texts into one document, and we'll share that with each other the next time around.
Well,
sound like a good idea?
It may be. What do you think?
I think that'll work. I mean, it'll get me to do something, you know, that I haven't done in years. As far as
I haven't ever combined those pieces. I've done two of those pieces, but I've never done the second one, and I've never done all three together.
Right. So. And then next month we'll you know, if you want to consult the craft books, we can come up with a different exercise, something else that we can create. But yeah, the next episode we'll share whatever it is that we've created. You know, we can talk about it, talk about other things that we've, you know, discovered or found out that might be able to guide us into. But I think if we create exercises, create challenges in each episode for ourselves to kind of push ourselves beyond our comfort zone, whatever that might be, I think we'll be doing okay. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
All right.
Sounds good to me.
So those are our rules, and I will include those rules in the show notes.
Okay.
So that anybody that's following along and wants to do that with us, and so we'll also have a reference.
Yeah, do you want to send them?
And I'll send them to you so you have them before the show goes up, because this show will go up. Well, we can talk about that once we stop the recording, but I'm going to turn that off now.
Sure. Yeah. Whenever you want to.
It'll be in the show notes. Yay. Thanks, Stephen. All right. There you have it. The laboratory number one. Be sure to check the show notes for the exercise rules. And if you want, send your results in to us. We'd love to see them. And that's it. Be back in a month for a new laboratory. Be back in a week for the new shop talk. And be back in 2 weeks for an interview with God knows who it's going to be. I don't know. I invoked God. Did I just invoke God? I'm a Buddhist sort of atheist. Whatever. Invoke God. Buddha! Cheese! Whatever.